Thank you, David, for I thought I told you to use a short form introduction and you didn't do it. I'm Dick Wright and I'm a real alcoholic. I'm awfully glad to be here with you this morning. I made a note for myself, and that's all, and that is that I do want to thank the committee at Mount Eagle for asking me to come up. Sometimes when I'm asked to be the speaker, I'm not the first choice, and in this particular case, I wasn't, but when you got a good friend and a sponsor by the name of Bill Crawford, he'll do all sorts of things for you, and when Milton called Bill, and Bill said, gee, I'm tied up, I can't do it, he suggested me, and I'm grateful that I was asked to come. It's been a very meaningful weekend for me. I want to thank Larry and Peggy and my friend Charles for setting the pace. I want to thank Roe for leading that good discussion yesterday afternoon, and some others that I have had some in close one-on-one discussions with this weekend who have meant so much to me, because I get a lot out of these things. I'm just glad to be here. I said I was a real alcoholic, and that I do that for two reasons. We hear that some things read in the beginning of meetings now, that, you know, please limit your discussions to your problems with alcohol. Folks, you don't have to worry about that. I'll do that, you know. You don't have to worry about that. I haven't got anything else to talk about except that, so I'll limit my talk to my problems with alcohol. Another reason I say that is because I'm a classic case. I'm a classic case of alcoholism. I'm a classic case of what happened, because I'm the product of a real 12-step call, and I'm a classic case of what this program offers, I think, in the lives of any person who takes it seriously. Who has Bruce read is willing to go to any length. And we discussed Thursday night at that little gathering we had about the limitlessness of the program, that there are no limits on recovery. And so I say I'm a real alcoholic because you can read about me in the book. You don't have to listen to what I say this morning. You can read about me anywhere in this book, and you'll see how I fit in very clearly and distinctly. I was thinking about how great the committee's been since we've been here. Been great. Maybe, though, Milton, you could give the speakers a little more prominent thing to wear, you know? At Fellowship by the Sea, they give you a big one like this. It got a big red ribbon on it. I was sitting down there in the lobby, and a friend of mine, an Al-Anon from Mayo, from male member of Al-Anon from Charlotte, come by, and he looked at me and he said, he says, you look like you just won first place in the cattle judging contest. And since it's obvious that the people who run the raffle take the speaker's tickets out of there before they call, that would be a nice... I want to get done with a few statistics here so that you'll understand how I'm going into this thing. David, I'm taking my watch off. That'll tell you don't have to watch yours, because I won't watch mine either. But I do have one. I'm a member of the Indian Trail group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Indian Trail, North Carolina, a suburb of Charlotte. I've been a member of the Indian Trail group in good standing since I moved there in the summer of 1987. Before I went to Charlotte area, I lived in Atlanta, and all the time I was there, from 1980 to 1987, I was a member in good standing of the Memorial Drive Beginners Group in Stone Mountain. And before I moved to Atlanta, I was a member in good standing of the Lawndale Group in Greensboro. I tell you that for a purpose, that I've always had a home group wherever I've gone, and I've always made sure that I had one very quickly, and I've stuck with those home groups Now, those groups haven't always done what I wanted them to do. But because, again, of this powerful program and my ability to apply the 12 traditions to my my interpretation of what those groups were doing, I've been able to maintain my allegiance to those three home groups throughout my period of sobriety. And I intend to continue to do that. The home group is important to me. I was born on August 19, 1930. And so those of you that are running that through, I'll help you. I'll be 47 my next birthday. And we were talking this morning. I was talking with Kay this morning. I don't grow old gracefully or graciously. So I was born in Auburn Memorial Hospital in Auburn, New York, a town about 25 miles west of Syracuse, in between Syracuse and Rochester in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. I didn't live in Auburn. I lived about 7 miles outside of it. Now, I've heard everybody here tonight talk about how insignificant their little town was that they grew up in. So I'll tell you, I grew up in Fosterville, New York. Nobody knows where that is. It's a little village of about 100 people if you go out a half a mile, you know. So, and I was raised on a farm out there in the country. And that tells you about all you need to know about my early upbringing. Depression, things weren't great, but they were good. We hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous today about seems to be the thing to try to put your finger on why I'm an alcoholic. You know, to look in the past and find something to hang my hat on back there. And I've done that. I hear about hereditary predisposition to alcoholism. And I looked at that, and I looked back in my family, and sorry to say, I couldn't find anything. Oh, I heard about old Uncle Luther who had a little something wrong up here, and he did some funny things and sat around the old cook stove and was arrogant and miserable and hard to get along with. But I think he finally took his life, but I didn't find anything. So I've been able to discount the hereditary predisposition to alcoholism. I've heard about the dysfunctional family too, Peggy. And I've looked at that. And I just want to endorse what Peggy said. My family was dysfunctional after a while. But they were dysfunctional because I was a part of it. And not because they were inherently that way. On the contrary, I was raised in a situation which should have prepared me to enjoy life as everyone else can out there, the benefits of it, and lead a sociable and an agreeable and happy and joyous life. Introduced to good people, taught good standards, taken to church at a little Methodist, when they used to call it Methodist Episcopal Church back there in the little village, and was taken there and learned those things and was under the tight control of my father. My father was a farmer railroad man. He, a combination, and he believed that all work and no play didn't hurt you a bit, and he drilled that into me. So I grew up with a good set of standards and good people as role models and good things. There was a lot of love and a lot of warmth. I have a sister who's 7 years younger than I am, and that tells you about all you need to know. Now, as I look back on my life, I can tell you that for the first several years while I was under the influence of and the control of that nice little comfortable tight community farming situation out there, and my father did maintain good control of it because he was a strong disciplinarian, I didn't have any trouble getting along in life. I was kind of content with what was going on. I liked the people that I was associating with. I didn't mind the standards and the code of conduct that were suggested. I didn't have any trouble with that. But, you know, I reached an age, I don't know what it was, 12 years old. Charles talked about it, you know. Something happens. Those body juices start flowing and stuff like that. And my mind changed. My mind changed. And I decided right on my own that maybe I had a better way. And so I started to kind of distance myself from these good people and these good standards and this good code of conduct and this control that I was in. And I started out to make my own rules, my own standards, and to develop my own circle of friends and acquaintances. I remember that. Remember about the time I did it. And I can tell you that immediately I began to have trouble getting along in life. Dr. Silkworth, in the book, uses three terms to describe what happened to me. I became restless, irritable, and discontent with life. And I began then a string of events which were totally atypical of what had been happening in my life, which had been good. I began to have trouble getting along. I got thrown out, of a little one-room schoolhouse that I'd been going. I got thrown out of that thing in the sixth grade. Now, that's bad. As far as I know, I'm the only kid that ever got thrown out of that little one-room schoolhouse before they shut it down. That little one-room schoolhouse was cut out of about an acre cut out of my father's farm, and my father was a trustee of that school district, and yet my behavior was so disgustingly antisocial, a quote out of the book, by that time, as I was restless, irritable, and discontent with life, I got thrown out of there, had to go to high school ahead of my peers, and start out there with them, ride the bus. Milk the cows earlier, you know, do those kind of things so I get on that bus. Well, I'd like to tell you that I learned from that. You see, in my trek into alcoholism, there were a lot of red flags that went up. Big ones, you know, that were waving and said, this ought to get your attention, Richard. But I never saw them. That was one. You know, I didn't catch that. I should have gone on and said, you better behave and get on through your education here, but I had to leave that high school. I developed one of the great alcoholic characteristics. I was great out of the gate. You know, starting gate, I was great. Man, I'd get going. Great ideas, great plans, you know. Had a little trouble finishing. I'd kind of peter out in a stretch, you know, and I'd get some things, I'd see something over here, you know, and it'd divert my attention. Pretty soon I'd not finish. Everybody else was finished, and I'd have to do something else. And I had to do something else in that high school, and I got thrown out of there. You know, it seemed like these issues that were bothering me, these conflicts that I was having with people, they always won. And I always lost, and I'd end up going somewhere else. So I ended up going over to the high school in the town where my father was a Lehigh Valley Railroad freight agent. And so I had to ride over to him every morning, home at night, and go to that school to finish up my senior year because I was. And so that was to start a long trek of difficulties. You see, I began to manifest the disease of alcoholism long before I took a drink. One of the things I did along here, too, I started to hang around with some guys that were older than I was, then became my role models, and they did some things that I thought were risky and adventuresome and you know, challenging. And one of the things they did one night when we were on our way up to a little drive-in theater where we used to watch movies in the summertime, was they stopped by a place and got something to drink, took it up there with them, and I watched them. I saw that these fellas were, they something happened to them when they drank that, and maybe I was missing out on something, so I, next time I had a chance, I had squirreled a little money, and we stopped in that place called the Rainbow Inn. I think there's a Rainbow Inn in every county in this country. I bought a quart of Roma port wine. 86 cents, I think. And I pulled my t-shirt out of my overalls, and I put that down there, pulled my t-shirt out over, and walked on up to the drive-in, and I sat up there, and I drank that quart of Roma port that night out in the weeds, sitting up against the old apple tree watching the movie, and had a bad night. I know that surprised you. I had a bad night. I got rolling around in the dirt and the weeds, you know. I couldn't function anymore. I wet my pants. I hadn't done that in a while. I'd quit doing that younger. One of those standards I'd learned as a youngster, you know, and I hadn't done that. And I puked a lot that night, too. I had a bad time, when I got home, that didn't stop. That lasted all night. You know, I slept in an old bed upstairs. It rolled in the middle. Didn't have inner spring mattresses on. I jumped on that so much it had a spot right in the middle. When you got in there, you were kind of trapped in there. And I wasn't in any condition that night to remove myself from that entrapment, and that stuff continued. So it was an awful mess. And in the morning, there was the anger of my father and the concern and sadness on my mother, and the bewilderment in the eyes of my sister, because that's the first time that had ever happened. And as we alcoholics will do, time healed that, and I worked my way out of it. But I want to tell you what I learned. Sometime between the time I took the cap off that Port Aroma port wine and before I got rolling around in the weeds, sometime in there, I passed through a little section of time when my life was a whole lot better, when I was no longer restless and no longer irritable and no longer discontent, when the dirt and stink and sweat and hard work of the farm didn't bother me anymore, and where I could mix with these guys and I was funnier and I felt better with them, and where I could dream about how good it was going to be next week or next month or next year. Little section of time. When this thing was all over, and I came out of that initial episode, guess what I remembered? Didn't remember the heartache and the sadness and the anger and all the difficulty. I remembered that little section of time when my life was better, and I took that on into my life. Got into college, got a little piece of an education, enlisted in the Air Force in January 1951 to beat the draft, did it by something like 3 or 4 days. My draft notice came 3 or 4 days after I enlisted in the Air Force, and I went in and I carried this piece of information with me. See, I'd already learned to use that information whenever things weren't going well, whenever I felt bad, whenever I needed to deal with something, I carried that information. There was something there that would help me, and I used it. I began to use alcohol immediately for that purpose. I stayed in the Air Force nearly 11 years, and very quickly, here are the things that occurred there, because a lot of my story develops here, but it won't take me long to tell it. You can read about it in the book. I got in the pilot training program. Fortunate to do that. See, another thing that had happened, along in one of my later years in college, before I went into service, I had a good semester. I was taking some courses that I liked. Now, that was a strange event for me, because I hadn't had a lot of good semesters. You know, I wasn't going to be a Rhodes Scholar. I wasn't going to graduate summa cum whatever from there, But I had a good semester, and I got some great grades, and I liked it, and I got a little taste of success. That's not good for an alcoholic either. When you had going for you what I had going for me, that's not a good thing to happen. I got a little taste of success, and so I went on into the service, and I got in the pilot training program. I did okay with it. Commissioned, got my wings. Ended up flying airplanes in the Strategic Air Command, and and during the Korean War, and I got my commission and got my combat crew just before the Korean War ended, and so I never went over there. My records were on the West Coast, I never went, but that's, I met a lady in Tampa, Florida, who has been circulating around with us this weekend, and I swept her off her feet, and we were eventually. When I was transferred up in the northeastern part of the state of Maine, in Limestone, Maine, in the middle of the winter in 1955, I finally decided that was bad up there to be alone, and I called her and we got married up there. We had two daughters born to us while we were stationed there, and a lot of things happened. The fellow that, I had a lot of good things occur. I was reading over some old military stuff, and I can see that this bill said the drive for success was on. And that little bit of success I had continued to plague me and bother me, because things went pretty well. I did some pretty good things, you know, on paper. I had been a good officer and a good pilot and a good military man. As these years unfolded, I probably was not a good husband nor a good father. Certainly, I'd forgotten all about those standards and the good things that I'd been taught as a youngster, totally disassociated myself with those. Had no conception any longer of the possibility of a power greater than myself leading me or helping me in life. Totally abandoned that and went on through life. Things went pretty well. Promoted ahead of my peers, got my own combat crew. Did things like that, had some good reports, not a good husband, not a good father, no good standards, no God, alcohol becoming a more important part. I was in a good situation to drink, and I drank a lot, all the time. I got a friend in Greensboro, North Carolina, who talks about the roller coaster. Okay, you know the roller coaster, you start out like this and then you go up that first thing, you know, and it takes you a long time, clickety, 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 going up there. That's the way it was with me. And you get to the top of that first thing, and the next minute, in the blink of an eye, at the bottom. And that's kind of the way it happened to me. Now, on good analysis, it might look a little slower than that, but it looks like one day I was able to do the things I was expected to do, be where I was expected to be, say what I was supposed to say, not say what I shouldn't say. And the next day, I couldn't do any of those things. But the more important thing was that as I look at it, I didn't care that I couldn't. And my career and my life went downhill like that roller coaster in a hurry. My world became filled with narrow-minded people. The military folks were narrow-minded. Bob S., the guy that Dave was talking about, he read my military records one time, and while we were still in Greensboro, I said, "Here, Bob, look at these records." And he looked through there, and he said, 1961 wasn't one of your better years, was it? And it wasn't. I mean, I'll tell you how it went fast. I look at my officer effectiveness reports in there, and I see 7 years of middle of the page going up toward the right-hand column, better, better, better. Last one that I, one of them in there in April of 1960 said, outstanding, right-hand column, can't get any higher. My commander said one of the top three of the 22 captains reporting to me. Not bad, not bad. 10 months later, there's one in there. There'd been a little incident. We'd been transferred down to Ramey Air Force Base in Puerto Rico, and there'd been a little incident involving a Tech Sergeant Duke Duvall and I had gone on a little expedition out drinking, and the air police were involved, and both of us were drunk, and there'd been that incident, and bang, you know, 10 months after this outstanding efficiency report, back in the middle where it was 7 years earlier. 10 months later, they had convened a board of officers made up of two major generals and a brigadier general to determine whether or not I should be retained on active duty status. And they quickly determined that I should not. And the reasons were many, the incidents were many, and the cause was alcoholism, acute, chronic, severe. For those of you that are just normal, middle-of-the-road alcoholics, in writing I had my diagnosis. I'd spent better than 50% of the last 9 months of 1961 locked up somewhere in neuropsychiatric facilities, locked wards, and finally the solitary confinement section of the base stockade on Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, where I received a general discharge on Christmas Eve, 1961, and went back home. Did what all good 31-year-old married men with a wife and two kids ought to do. Moved back in with my mother. My recently widowed mother. Third chapter of the book talks about me. Talks about in the first paragraph my unwillingness to admit that I was different from other people. Had all the evidence that I needed, had it in writing, had all these things that Bob had read that day about through what happened in 1961, had that report from that board. I can't read. The rest of you, you see, you got to sit back and think, I wonder if I'm alcoholic. Let me see what I did, whose lives I affected. But not me. He made it real simple for me. All I got to be able to do is read. Because they give you a copy of that stuff, you know, to carry with you. Unwilling to admit that I was different. Countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people, that paragraph goes on and says, and there were those attempts. I wouldn't drink for a while, and Doug and I were talking about this last night. I wouldn't drink for a while, and then all of a sudden I'd have to have a drink, you know. I'd have a bad day. Or I'd have an average day. Or I'd have a good day. And I'd need to feel better, and I'd take a drink, and I'd be out of business. Got a job in the insurance industry, which I worked for years in and retired from. Which was good to me, and maybe I was good to it, thanks to you people. And when I wasn't drinking, I had a knack of stumbling up the ladder of success a little bit because I would work hard when I wasn't drinking. And I went to work for this company back in upstate New York in 1964, transferred to Greensboro as the manager of the operations for that company in that state, and moved my family down there. And there were still countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people, although I had some things going for me. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, unwilling to believe that I was different. Had it there in writing, still carrying that file with me. Can't read. Can't read. I think it was October 11th, probably 1965, coming back from the office, I stopped by a place called The Mug in Greensboro just to have a couple of beers. I had a bad day. I had a normal day, or I had a good day. I needed to feel better. Had a couple of beers. Sunday morning, the 17th of October, 1965, I was sitting in the corner of the living room at 3705 Normandy Road in Greensboro, drinking out of a quart of White Horse Scotch, chasing it with Pall Mall cigarettes, sitting there in the corner of the living room in my underwear. Hadn't been to work all week, hadn't bathed, hadn't shaved, hadn't eaten, had drank around the clock again, and was again out of business. I drank in my underwear for several reasons. I had some personal hygiene problems when I drank. And I found that I could minimize the impact of those problems the less clothes I had on. So I would just drink in my underwear, finally, and that solved some of the problems. As I sat there doing a little social drinking that Sunday morning, not harming a soul in my underwear, the two daughters who were ages 8 and 6 at the time had been next door to a neighbor's house for 2 or 3 days because Barbara wisely put them there since I was inappropriate to be around. And they weren't there, and you know, I'd been in this condition many times before, but I can't tell you what happened. A friend of mine in Greensboro talks about this roller coaster, says, for those of you that don't understand what happened, no explanation is possible. For those of you that do, none is necessary. But that morning, as I sat there in that condition, with all that stuff going on, a condition I had been in many times before, something happened. My life, Peggy, did kind of flash before me. and I saw exactly what happened. I saw exactly for the first time what was wrong. I was incapable of doing that, folks, but I saw what was wrong. I saw all this path of destruction, and I saw what I'd left back there, and I saw what was happening that day, and I saw what was going to be in store for me in the future, but more important, I saw what the problem was. The problem wasn't them, and it wasn't her, and it wasn't all this other stuff. It was me, and it was that stuff I was drinking. Period. And I laid it up, gave it to her. Don't know what happened to that. She doesn't either. But anyway, after church was out that day, I called a minister of a Methodist church that we were affiliated with on paper, asked him if he'd come. He did. He came very quickly, immediately, and he talked to me. And I remember his words. I said, for those of you that are concerned, I had to put on some clothes. I had... Everybody's always concerned about that, you know, but I did put on some clothes, and I asked him. I told he's the first person I ever told exactly what was going on, what had happened, and what was happening. And he says, he looked at me with all the compassion and love and an understanding that anybody could muster, and he says, I can't help you. But he says, I know some people that can. Will you let me call him? And I said, call him, and he did. So for those of you that want to argue the product of third-party 12-step calls endlessly, I'm the product of one, because he called two men, and they came just as fast as he did. And one of them was a fellow by the name, man by the name of Boyd Christopher, a big man, more ways than one, member of that church. The other one was Wade. And they came in and they made a classic 12-step call on me in the living room of that house that day on October 17, 1965. And I haven't drank since. Just like that. These two fellas shared with me like the book says. They told me about things that they had done, feelings that they had felt, thoughts that they had thought. They shared with me the way they drank. One of them hadn't had a drink in 9 years, and the other one in 5 years. I was amazed. These fellows thought, acted, felt, and drank like I did. And they'd found something. I'd tried to find something, and I never could. Somehow I knew this afternoon that I had found something from these men. In the December 1987 grapevine, there's an article entitled, "A Man with a Big Red Parrot on His Shirt." Don't know why that caught my eye, but I read it. And it's a story about a fellow who was locked up in a padded room on a locked ward in the county hospital where he had been committed. Now, I know something about his surroundings, you see. I know a lot about those conditions because I've been in them. And he wanted some help, and the nurse said, "Nobody will come and see you under these conditions," but she, for some reason, made a call, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous came and came through the door, smiling compassionately. Man had a big red parrot on his shirt. And he shook out his hand, stuck out his hand, and compassionately shook the hand of this fella in the padded room. Here's what the fella said. He said, "As he shook my hand, the miracle which had been passed on to Dr. Bob many years before continued its eternal journey." Continued its eternal journey. Early in the afternoon on October 17, 1965, two men reached out their hand to me, and the miracle that had been passed on to Dr. Bob continued its eternal journey into my life and the life of those who are close to me. And he talks about this miracle, the free gift of sobriety, period. Freely given, mine for the asking. So all I have to do is be willing, he says. The only difference between those who make it and enjoy happy lives, a willingness to take this simple set of tools, as the book said, laid at my feet that day. The unwilling fall by the wayside, go mad, as Bill says, and die. And I had that willingness. I became willing to go that afternoon to any length to get sober. Those fellows said, "Do you want to go to a meeting tonight?" I said, "Yes." They took me to Burlington, North Carolina. There was no speaker meetings in Greensboro at that time. We went to Burlington. Met a lot of fine people there, some still alive, some I still know. Don't remember what was being said, but let me tell you some of the things that impressed me that night. You got to remember what kind of condition I was in. I'd been sucking on that jug for about six days around the clock. I wasn't in robust health. I wasn't able to sort things out in my mind, yet there were things that registered that night. One of them was a serenity prayer, that thing we kind of recite in AA meetings. But I heard that term, serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And I remember saying, that's been a problem for me. Maybe I can use that. That's been a problem. Don't remember much else that was said that night. I got a chip, largely the way that some of the others who have spoken here this weekend got theirs. I didn't say, I see these folks come in the program today, they come through the door, they're shaking hands, slapping, yes, whistling, you know, like they're in a political rally. And I wasn't like that. Boyd had put me on a chair about where Glenn's sitting there, and he sat on the inside of me. He was about 6'6", 250 pounds, plumber. And when they gave out the chips, I felt myself getting up. And I think he might just have pushed me just a little bit, because in my condition, all you had to do is change the center of gravity, you see, and I was on my way. And so I picked up a white chip. And I remember after the meeting, the 15 or 20 people that were there in the Burlington group came up and they shook my hand. And they said, "We understand." I knew you did. I could tell. I could tell about the warmth. I could tell about your dry hands. I could tell that you understood about this thing in my belly, this stuff whirling around through my head, the puffiness in my face, the flushed feeling I had. Always hot, you know. I wanted to be cool, and I was always hot. I knew you understood that. I knew that. Here the day was almost over, but I'd already received two great things. Didn't know it at the time. Hope and understanding. Been a long while since I'd had either one of those. Hadn't had them in a long time. In fact, I'm not sure I knew what they were. I got them that day. Got some other things too. Wade said, the other thing that I remember happened was that I had experienced two men who had found a program which had saved their life. Two men who had thought, acted, felt, and drank the way I did. Now I had seen where they came to join with each other, to learn about these things, and to put them into practice. Two very, very important tools for me that day. Incapable of sorting out most things out in my mind, but was able to understand a little bit of that. On the way home, Wade said, I made a mistake. If you're new in the program, don't make this mistake. I made a mistake. I asked Wade how many meetings I should go to. Ought not to do that, you know. And Wade had a way of getting up close to you and talking. He'd point at you. Sometimes he would touch me. He said, 7 a week will be enough for you. He didn't ask me what my social calendar looked like. He knew I didn't have one. I hear a lot about soccer practice today. And he didn't ask me about how many soccer practices my kids had during the week. He said 7 a week will be enough. He also said something to me. He says, after what's happened to you today, you never got a drink again if you don't want to. And for the first time in my life, I understood that if I drank again, it was because I chose to, because now I had been introduced to a program. Now I had been introduced to a place where you people gathered, and if I drank again, it was because I chose to. Those fellows nurtured me back to physical health. That next week, they watched me every minute of the day. They'd call me first thing in the morning. They'd pick me up in the middle of the morning. We'd have coffee. They'd pick me up at noon, and we'd go to lunch, and they'd eat. We'd get coffee in the middle of the afternoon. At 5 o'clock, we'd meet at Franklin Drugstore for coffee where a bunch of alcoholics met. At 7:30, the horn would blow, and we'd go to O. Henry Group on Monday night and Open Door Group on Tuesday night, Fisher Park on Wednesday, Dogwood on Thursday. They took me. Friday night, they let me go myself. The group met only 3 blocks from where I lived, and they thought I could handle it. And that's how I was introduced to this great program that was to save my life. These guys spoon-fed the program of recovery to me, and they got me busy. Some of the rewards go like this, folks. It began to happen shortly. I didn't sleep or eat for many days. And Thursday night, I was at the Dogwood group, and I was up at the standing up, and an old white-haired fellow named Otto Boone. Otto's dead now. He came up to me, and he said, Dick, you're looking great. I said, I ain't feeling very good, Otto. He says, how come? I said, I can't sleep. Otto was going to give me some great piece of wisdom about that, because I could tell. And here's what he said. I never heard anybody dying from lack of sleep. I said, when am I going to sleep? He said, when you get sleepy enough. But he didn't stop there. He went up to the literature rack and he got a little piece of non-conference approved literature. It's called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And he gave me that little bifold or trifold card, and he said, well, your problem is that you're mind is wrestling with all these things, all the problems of yesterday, the fears of tomorrow, current conditions not being where you want them. He said, take this and see if you can read it, and maybe it'll help you. I was following instructions, so I took that home, and that night I went to bed, and before I smoked my last cigarette, I read that thing through very carefully. And I tried to force out of my mind the things of yesterday that were bothering me. And I tried very hard to force out of my mind the fears of what tomorrow may bring. And instead, I became grateful for those things that I still had. A wife who stuck by me all those years, thick and thin. Two little girls over yonder in the bedroom. Little place to live, job that where I... And next thing I know, it was 7 o'clock in the morning. And I've slept all night. Great reward. Little things like that, you know. I got in the program fast and rapidly, and with the help of these fellows, they made me the secretary of a chairman, they called it back then, didn't they, Charles, around where we were, your chairman for 3 months. And then most of the meetings were speaker meetings. You did everything. You set it up, you made the coffee, you brought the cookies, you got the ashtrays out, don't have to worry about that much anymore. You chaired the meeting, you got the speakers, you shut it down, and you cleaned things up, and you locked the church. For 15 of the next 18 months, I did that at some group in Greensboro. I was doing that. They kept me busy, but they did some other things, you know, for me. They helped me work through the steps and develop a program that was sufficient to sustain me for times when I couldn't be with you people in your setting, when business would take me out of town and I couldn't be there. But I went to a lot of meetings. I love the fellowship. Bill says in chapter 2, there's two things that hold us together. One is the power of the fellowship, having shared in a common peril. I love that because I understand that fellowship. I experienced it that first night in Burlington, the next night at O'Henry. I experienced it on Wednesday night at the Matthews group in Charlotte. I experienced it the moment I got here Thursday, and I experienced it all weekend. I love the fellowship. But he goes on to say that that's only part of the cement that holds us together. Said the other part of the cement that holds us together is a stronger part, that we have found a common solution on which we can agree, a way out. And then he tells me about 3 or 4 pages later what that is. He tells me that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. I didn't like that very well. I was hoping you folks would tell me that a change of diet would be. Or a healthier exercise program, or maybe a change in climate or something like that. But you tell me now that there are two powers, and the important power is that I must have a deep and effective spiritual experience. And these fellows saw to it that I was able to practice and work a program which led to that. I've never been a bystander in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always been, from that moment on, very active. In 1980, we moved to Atlanta, and I stayed active there all the time I was there. And in 1987, back to Charlotte, I've been active there since. The things that have happened are miraculous. Some people look at me and they look at my circumstances today. Some of the people I sponsor, and I sponsor an awful lot of them. They look at me and they think, well, you know, life must have been an easy street since you came in and got sober. Must have been easy street for you. Everything, you know, downhill with the wind at your back, you know, and it hasn't been. It hasn't been. There have been obstacles. There have been challenges. There have been challenges in every department of my life. And that life has been pretty full. There was a fella in Greensboro early on, his name was Worth Williams. Worth is dead, but Worth headed up the Alcohol Information Center in Greensboro. And I remember him talking to Lawndale Group one night, and he talked about his shoebox of life. He says his life is the joyousness and happiness and freedom and contentment and serenity that he experiences today depends on how well he has filled up his shoebox of life. And he talked about the things that went in that box. First thing he put in there, program of Alcoholics Anonymous, meeting people in the program. But he says that's not all. The box would be lopsided. I had to put in other things, family, community, vocation, church. Oh, he said that. I didn't say that. Church. It's part of mine. Other things. So I learned from that, and I tried to fill that shoebox up shortly after the beginning because I heard the big message. So I did that. And because of that, and as a result of that, there have been challenges and things that have happened. But because of the power of the program and for nothing else, and the God of my understanding, which you led me to, remember, I had no acquaintance with him for years. I hear people say, I prayed to him to get me out of this thing, and I'd never do it again. You see, I never thought that was possible. I felt that because of my unworthiness, that I had removed myself too far so that I couldn't do that. But I very quickly understood that I needed to reestablish a contact with him, and I did, thanks to you people. Here are some of the things that he's worked me through. My vocation has been was a challenging one. It had lots of challenges, and there were a lot of things in there that it looked like it was great, and it permits you to do some things because it was financially rewarding to me. But it wasn't all a bed of roses. I had some challenges there. I spent many months in a very, very intense proxy fight for that corporation in which I was leading the group that was trying to fend off those who would take us over. And if it hadn't been for going to meetings at night on Main Line, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where my corporate office was, and trying to learn how to stay calm and use the program to help me in that, I might have blown that. I could have blown that. I certainly couldn't have stayed serene and content throughout that. There were things like that. There have been challenges in my personal family life most recently there have been challenges. I'd like to tell you that the program has been so dynamic for me that all I've had to do is kind of drift on through and all of these things have occurred, but that's just not the case. They haven't come to me quickly and easily at times. So there's some times when I don't feel as if my prayers get as far as the ceiling. There are times when I feel estranged from God and from the power of the program. But I have never, never abandoned the idea that even in those times I needed to continue to go through the motions. Jerry said this Thursday night. Mechanical sobriety, I call it, just kind of going through the motions. While I was up in Philadelphia in a corner office of a corporate office building, if you got a rectangular building, there ain't but four of them, and this company was going through this problem, I was going to meetings. I was having a hard time with my boss, the number one guy. He and I weren't getting along. One of the other company people said, we can feel it when the two of you in the same room. I was trying to deal with that. I was trying to deal with that. I went back to Atlanta where I still lived. I went to Phil over the weekend. I'd come back and I'd have AA and Al-Anon material in my pocket like this, you know, and I'd go back up there and I'd try to deal with that, and I couldn't. I went to Monday night, I went to a Paoli meeting. Some guy had brought in a newcomer from Phoenixville there, said something. Don't know what it was. Can't remember today. Light bulb went off. Knew what I had to do. Had peace for the first time in many weeks. Peace of mind. Started to do that the next morning. Cleaned that up, folks. Walked away a free person. Those are the kind of things like Otto's giving me that yesterday, today, and tomorrow that occur to me. Life goes on, Charles. Been those things. Most recently, some of them have been in my family. I'll tell you the situation today. The two, Barbara and I have been together for 41 and a half years or more. And always been blissful. Been some challenges here and there. Still are today. Working through those. The two girls that were next door, were the last day I took a drink because I was unfit to be around. They're grown and educated and got two fine husbands with whom I'm well pleased. Got six grandchildren. See, I'd have missed all that, you know, if it hadn't been for you folks. I'd have missed it all. Another example, January 29th, I had to put my mother in a nursing home up in Auburn, New York. My sister and I knew we were going to have to do it. She didn't know that we were going to do that because she's got Alzheimer's and can't communicate. And that was an extremely difficult thing for me to do. This was a lady who had always supported me, who had never had an unkind thing to say about me, despite she knew me for what I was. And I was having a tough time with that in that day when I was going to do it in the afternoon. While I was up there, I get two telephone calls from my guys back in Matthews who told me they were had already been praying for me that day and they knew what I was going through and they wanted to wish me well. Those are the kind of things. I'd like to tell you that all of my six grandchildren are physically healthy and mentally healthy, but I got a little grandchild that got some problems like her grandpa. She had got some things that ain't quite all wired up like other folks. Mine was with alcoholism and emotions. Hers was with some other things, but she's an autistic child. And you can tell by me that I'm paternalistic. Can you tell that I like to? I want to take that little girl and take her in my arms, and I want to fix her because I want her to have the best. But I can't do that quite like that. But because of you people and the power, like putting my mother in a nursing home, with the power that you people have given me and that God gives me in His grace every day, I'm available to be of assistance, to make most things available to this little girl so that her life will be everything that God intended it to be with no limits. I love her to death. I'd love to fix her today, but I can't. So here's a couple of incidences recently which take on a new meaning of powerlessness in my life, which I've been able to overcome and deal with because of this program. You know, I like to talk about some funny things like everybody else. But some of the things that I read that are humorous in the program of AA, I read in a newspaper, and I read in the Charlotte Disturber fairly recently in the same issue, the same publication, same daily issue, I read some things that are humorous, and one of them had to do with John Wayne Bobbitt. Remember Bobbitt? Well, this didn't have to do with his main order of business. This had to do with a sentencing hearing that he had after he'd beat up his new girlfriend. I hope he'd gotten that other thing taken care of. But here's what the judge sentenced him to do. This is a quote now. Attend impulse control and AA meetings. Well, you know, I look at that and I say, what's wrong with this picture? I want to take the judge and I want to say, let me talk to you over here, judge, at the side Let me talk to you at the sidebar over here. I learned that term recently. And let me talk to you at the sidebar and say, Judge, what you need to do is get this other way around. Tell them to go to AA meetings. Latch on to what 2 million plus people have latched onto that saved their life. And his impulses will get controlled. He won't have to worry about that. See, that's what I want to tell him. We get these things. Another one in the same paper had to do, where are the folks from Aiken, South Carolina? They'll identify with it. Corrine Koenig. Now, that may not turn a light bulb on to you, but she had her sentence of 3.5 years reduced to 1 year and was let out of prison. And here's the reason that she did, that the parole board let her go early, was that she had completed 2 5-week courses on alcohol awareness, listen to that, and anger and stress management. Corrine Koenig, who had already been arrested and convicted at least once or twice for DUI, drunk again, had killed Strom Thurmond's daughter when she was sentenced to 3.5 years. Killed one of 100 U.S. senators' daughters, all over the paper, and yet she gets credit for completing a course on alcohol awareness. How much more aware do you have to be? I want to get the parole board over at the sidebar and say, let me tell you a little something. You send her to Alcoholics Anonymous and let her get a grip on what's influenced and turned the lives of 2 million people around to limitless possibilities. And she'll be able to control her anger and her stress. Bill says at the end of his chapter, Bill's story, he says, there is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some, he says, would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity. But just underneath, there's a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. There is underneath all this laughter and great time that we have a deadly earnestness. And this earnestness and this faith and this courage and this power has to work 24 hours a day in my life and through my life into the lives of others, or I perish. Been a long haul for me. There's no way to get from where I was that day to where I am today. But things are good. And all of these things are good because of the power that this program, God's grace that you gave back to me, have worked in and through me from the beginning through this morning. I've loved it. Been a great ride. Thank you, and God bless you, and have a safe trip home.